Welcome to New Persuasive Words, a podcast of hope seeking understanding. Join Scott Jones and Bill Bohr for an ongoing conversation about theology, culture, and politics. Funny, contentious, outrageous, there's something for everyone. And now, your hosts.
Welcome back to New Persuasive Words. I'm Scott Jones.
And I'm still Bill Bohr.
Still Bill Bohr. Back in the saddle again.
By the way, I have to say that I think podcasting brings out a certain part of me. For instance, like I have been resisting. I don't know that I had even made any comments on Facebook about anything meaningful or I hadn't really confronted anybody on Facebook for probably over a year or maybe even longer than that. And I start podcasting and I just can't help myself.
Well, Bill, this is the side we like of you. We like a Bill that cannot help himself. That's really, I mean, right. Women like it. Pot, if the audience loves it, I mean, the unrestrained Bill.
Well, I'm not going to give the name of this person because he's trying to sell a book and I do not want to help him sell his book. But he made this statement, and of course, everybody on Facebook likes it. Ready for this profound statement? You're gonna love this, right? For Christianity to be Christ-like, we must reject original sin.
Well, this person's an idiot.
Well, guess what? I was going to let it go because really he's not asking my opinion about anything.
I know who this is, right?
Huh?
Do I know who this is?
You might know who this guy is, or you maybe not. He's part of these. It's funny. It's part of these, probably all these ex-evangelicals who suddenly think that progressive Christianity is a new thing. And for those of us who have been watching progressive Christianity die a slow, self-inflicted death, it's always fun to see people go ahead and drink the Kool-Aid. But here's what I responded. So let me repeat here. For Christianity to be Christ-like, we must reject original sin. And I'm doing a talk on St. Francis next week, so I've been rereading original sources and including. And then also reading G.K. Chesterton's biography of Francis. But anyway, so I said, okay, actually, to reject original sin is to become pagan-like. If you're very smart and moral, you might become a very noble pagan, which on the surface is much more attractive than much of Christianity. But you will both nullify grace and obscure Christ.
Well, I agree, and it's just silly. On top of that, I would think too. It's so intellectually counterintuitive. I actually think what do they say? People have said original sin is the only empirically verifiable Christian doctrine.
Yeah, right. That was Chesterton.
Yeah, I mean, this is like the atheist for Niebuhr at Harvard, right? I mean,
yeah.
this is. I think for most people, the original sin stuff is what makes sense, like the fact that somehow there's a tragic flaw in the human condition that seems pervasive, that it is that there's no sphere of human life that is original sin free. I mean, it doesn't matter if you're inside the church or outside the church.
Yep.
These to me seem so basic this is something that almost seems outside of the realm of
spiritual religion. No, you don't need the Bible at all. Well, this is interesting. You'll appreciate this because you can imagine. So he said, this is his response to me. You're going to love this. I think you're confusing original sin and sin, small s. I'm not saying sin doesn't exist. I'm saying original sin is a doctrine that should be left behind. Also, if we have the capacity to nullify grace, then it doesn't seem to be up for the challenge to begin with. And he actually got a couple hearts and six thumbs up for that. All right, would you like to hear my response?
What I want to hear first is the six people that liked it. So if I'm friends with any of them and I can unfriend them.
Oh, you might be. All right, so here's what I said. I go, actually not confused. And I go, I've read a lot of Brother Pelagius and some of his brighter modern heirs. I grant a lot of the traditional mythology around the doctrine is problematic, and late Augustine does feel Manichaean, as does hyper-Calvinism. Here's I'm trying to just offend everybody at this point, all right? But the fallenness of humanity is maybe the only article of faith that is supported by empirical evidence, like you just said. The history of Christianity is one long adventure in the penultimate nullifying of grace. And if both Jesus and Paul warned us of the possibility, then caution is merited. I do think / believe God's freedom to be gracious is not bound or limited by our tainted freedom or failures.
This is,
but
you're Facebook friends with this person, right?
I guess so. Well, here, and somebody said, Eastern Orthodoxy, Christianity doesn't teach or believe in a doctrine of original sin. Are they pagan? To which I said, well, a little bit. But I said, I actually am strongly influenced in my thinking about original sin by the Greek fathers and Orthodox tradition. I see it as both a problem of mortality / death and a spiritual sickness that all humanity shares.
Right, I mean, that's what's different, right? In the East, it's ontological, less forensic. Well, I mean, they're both ontological, right? In the East and
right,
West.
Right,
but,
right.
But you have this illness issue or the problem of sort of being, whereas I think in the West, from Augustine onward, you get a forensic problem. The problem is moral. Right. The problem is like a moral categorical problem, which leads to ontological issues. By the way, there's a great book on this. The best book I've ever read on the topic is by Henri Blochet, a French Reformed thinker. He wrote a book. It's probably only 130 pages or so, called Original Sin, Illuminating the Riddle. It is fantastic. And
Andre Blochet?
Henri, like Henry, like Henri.
Henri
Blochet, B-L-O-C-H-E-R. And he actually argues at the end, he talks about the problem with the Augustinian conception. And what he says, he argues that deprivation leads to depravity. So when we go east of Eden, he thinks there's kind of a withdrawal of the spirit, a certain kind of presence of the spirit, which actually changes the effect of human development, right? That we live east of Eden, and so we kind of come, it's not congenital sexually or something like it is for Augustine. It's this sort of, the environment changes the spirit.
No, that's interesting. You know, I don't know if this is Peter Brown, because I mean, I just spent a lot of time with Augustine in previous decades, but the idea of it, one of the best ways to understand it is for Augustine, sex is kind of the sacrament of sin in a way. I thought that's an interesting way because he says it's the most basic thing we do. We procreate. And yet as rational beings, it's one of the things we have least control over. And it's an interesting, it's this kind of wonderful, it is really this interesting merger of, you know, the best of Neoplatonic and Stoic thinking about what it means to have the good life with this Christian bent on it. And I think that's kind of an interesting way to think about it. Because Augustine might be one of the few church fathers that not only had plenty of sex, but liked it. So, you know,
although we thought if there was no fall, we wouldn't have any pleasure from procreation, right? We just sort of, our members would just sort of
just do a lot of this speculation, right? Yeah. Yeah.
Those would just be like blinking your eyes or something.
Well, right. That's like one of the more, I love the title, a literal commentary, Augustine's literal commentary
on Genesis
yeah. which is anything but literal. But anyway, so that's, you know, so I guess, you know, in a couple posts on Facebook, I've found that wonderful new persuasive word zone where in a few sentences we can offend both Calvinist and progressives.
I can't wait. Everybody just know that once this recording is off, I will find out who this person is. So in my head, I'm making a list of people it could be.
All right.
So I'm thinking this person is a Presbyterian.
Oh. I don't know, and I think he's kind of like part of the second wave or whatever that we're calling him now. But the folks that cut their teeth on the emerging church, but the next generation of them.
Oh, okay.
I think that's who this is, but I could be wrong. But we'll find out, right?
All right. Well, I'll this is interesting. Well, for me, see, now I've got something to look forward to at the end of the show.
Yeah. Well, speaking of original sin, you watched the Republican debate last night.
I did.
How about that for a segue?
Now, the best thing I learned, most disturbing, but best. Is that Mike Pence has been sleeping with a teacher for 38 years.
I did watch that clip. Oh, my God.
But you know what's so great? You know what's so great? He quickly qualified, but she's never been a member of a union.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, God forbid, you could sleep with a teacher. That's acceptable, but not a union member.
Yeah, no, because God knows they don't help their teachers because teachers left to the goodwill of school boards will do so well with their salaries. That's for sure.
Well, if you have any doubt about depravity, just look at that. Look at the debate last night. Original sin.
But let me say, the people behind the scene here. So you said you texted, I guess, late last night. Let's do a podcast on the debate. And then when I said to you, well, I didn't watch it, he goes, well, that's never stopped us before to talk about anything.
Absolutely. No, come on. What's that? Why start now?
But I will. Okay, so I didn't watch it, but I did watch a few clips, and I did read a couple summaries of it. And I want you to know that it made me that much more thankful, having read the summaries of it, that I did not watch it. But you're a better man than I am about this stuff.
Well, it was. I mean, it's entertaining. I mean, it's sort of like rubbernecking, the car accident or something.
Can I ask you a question?
Sick interest.
I don't like Chris Christie. I didn't like him as governor of New Jersey. There's many things about him that are problematic, but he always impressed me as a pretty bright guy. But when you take your shot and you go Donald Duck, that's the best thing he's got. That's the best nickname. You know, if you want to fight Donald Trump on the nickname game,
yeah, you don't.
And Donald Duck is the best you got. No, you don't do that. And no, no.
Well, and the other thing was when he looked at the camera and says, "Donald, you know, I know you're watching. Because you can't help yourself, Donald." And that was about the best thing I saw in the whole debate. I know a lot of people that think that Christie is kind of a Trump killer, and I don't think so at all. I don't think Christie's going to do it.
I don't think he's a man without a base.
Yeah. I mean, like, look, I mean,
if he got the nomination, he would not carry his own state.
No. Yeah, he would not. Right. He would not. And
no,
you know, The Hill had an interesting summary, and there, I mean, I agree. This is what I said as soon as the debate was over. I mean, Trump won the second debate. I mean, he's winning by not going.
Right. Sure.
And I would counsel him, if I was on his campaign, not to go as well. I mean, the stage is so bereft of political talent, and you just legitimize people. I mean, those people need the debates. He doesn't need them. He's 42 points up, and in both Iowa and Vermont and New Hampshire, rather, he's got
north
of 30 point leads. I mean, what is there to gain?
Right.
By going to a debate.
Right. What is that? Was it from the Adam Sandler movie where he had to debate and the principal says, "We are now all dumber"? Or was that from Old School? "We are now all dumber for that. May God have mercy on your soul." It's kind of like that, right?
The one thing I had not thought about, so one thing, you know, these are little tidbits. There was an argument about birthright citizenship, and I had never thought about this. Vivek, I can never remember his last name, but he was saying that, you know, if an ambassador from Mexico, if their child is born here, they're not a citizen. And I thought about that. I was like, that never occurred to me, because I just thought we have birthright citizenship.
Right.
But I think that's true, because the 14th Amendment says it only for people that are born under the jurisdiction. Right. That person would not be under the jurisdiction.
He's got diplomatic
immunity. Right.
Right.
So if you were from Mexico and you were undocumented, you would be under our jurisdiction. We could detain you. We could lock you up. We could send you back. So your child then would be a citizen.
Right. Right.
So because the child would be subject to American jurisdiction, it would be subject to our laws. So right. I had never thought about that. So yeah, I learned something.
There we go. Who did you? All right. Again, I'm not sure this is helpful, but who helped themselves? Who looked better? Or I mean, who looked semi-presidential last night?
Emphasis on semi.
Emphasis on semi.
I mean, look, Nikki Haley, I think, can put sentences together.
Well, yeah.
I mean, she's intelligent. I mean, DeSantis. He got a lot of time. I mean, he was in the middle because he's got the highest poll numbers, and he got a lot of airtime. I mean, I think, I didn't come away just thinking, I think Vivek, didn't have as good a night as he did the first night. And partially, I think that's because people were ready for him. I don't think people took him seriously the first time.
Right.
He kind of came out. And the guy actually has some rhetorical elan. And so I think people were ready for some of it. And look, the guy has a lot of positions that if you look at the guy's views on Israel or something, they are just outside of, I mean, his views on Israel are going to only appeal to maybe the far left of the United States, which he's not courting. Right. So I don't know, but Mike Pence just at one point was just seemed to be echoing peace through strength, peace through strength, peace through strength, with nobody listening. it was awkward. Like I said, just it's interesting because you contrast this with 2008 when I remember that election year and I remember watching those Republican primary debates. Am I thinking maybe of? Oh, yeah, 2008. I'm thinking 2008. Because you had a younger Huckabee, Romney, McCain, Rudy Giuliani. You had a pretty big, the guy, I'm trying to think of the governor. Bobby Jindal was 2012, I guess. But you had like some real like Republican talent. I just remember watching those debates and thinking, oh, okay, here's some people that, you know. I mean, Mike Huckabee at that point, before he kind of became Fox, you know, became that guy on Fox News on Sunday. People thought of Mike Huckabee as a political talent. I mean, it was you compare that, like, it's, you know, what are we, like 11 years later, 15 years later. It's just interesting to me how little talent I saw in the party. I mean, I don't know. I mean, there's got to be some governor or something or somebody out there that's better than this.
Right.
Or maybe there's not. It's just a big country. I mean, you know,
it's a big country.
Isn't there somebody managing a shoe store somewhere?
Well, I mean, I think the governor of Vermont is a Republican, and he's...
His dad was a congressman, right?
You know, yeah, and he's actually very... I mean, obviously Vermont is a pretty progressive state, but he's a very popular governor. He got reelected.
Why isn't that guy?
You know, his Republicanism is
that's
not
true.
There's not.
I guess if you're a guy like him, you wait out Trumpism. You figure, Trump's going to be done in the next election cycle, right? Win or lose, Trumpism's going to be over. So that's what I would have done if I were DeSantis too. I would have waited this out. And she's like, look, DeSantis is a young guy, and he's kind of trashing his brand right now. Where he could have sort of waited this out and been a candidate in 2028.
By the way, I'm just looking up. You made me want to think about the Republican primary of 2008. All right, McCain obviously won. Huckabee, Mitt Romney, Ron Paul. And Fred Thompson. Remember Fred Thompson?
And you know, Rick Santorum in that race?
No, not that one. That was Alan Keyes of blessed memory. Right. He's dead. Right. No, not Alan Keyes. Who did Trump kill at the rally? Not Alan Keyes.
Oh, Herman Cain.
Yeah, 999. Right. Yep. Duncan Hunter.
It was from California.
Rudy Giuliani. Sam Brownback dropped off.
Became governor of Kansas and bankrupted the state. Yeah. I mean, bad. I mean, literally bankrupted the state.
No. Yeah. No one else really worth talking about.
But that's to me, that's a much brighter field.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. And That was Giuliani before, you know, that was like he was obnoxious, but there was still a glow there from that. Yeah. But remember when he was elected mayor and his son was just acting like a total little jerk, and they did a skit on Saturday Night Live who played the son? Chris Farley played his son.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty
I remember
fun.
When Giuliani had that radio show when he was mayor, which was fantastic. And I remember this guy used to call him up, and he was mad because Giuliani banned ferrets. And he was like, sir, I think you have an unhealthy obsession with weasels. You need a therapist. You need help. But Giuliani was, Giuliani was the favorite in that race. Before that race started, he was like, and I mean, I remember
people
his polls good. Were like almost 20%. He was the front runner, and the debates ended that.
Can I periodically that, I guess it was a commercial or something where Giuliani's in drag.
Yeah.
And Trump is flirting with him.
I mean, look, he could be reading at your story hour in Vermont, certainly.
Yeah, I don't know. That's good to know. Well, probably there in, where was he in the, he showed up at the wrong place in Philadelphia. He thought it was the Hilton?
Oh, that was in, I thought that was in Jersey.
It was in your favorite part of Philadelphia. It was in the Northeast.
And he thought it was like a parts store.
Yeah, it was a parts store. Yeah. No. And it's a fine place to get a battery if you need one, car battery. But anyway.
So here's one of the things I was thinking about during the debate, because they were talking about education. And of course, it's like we're family, you know, we're going to give control to local schools and to families.
Right.
And I was thinking about, you know, Aristotle on politics, and Aristotle thinking about that basically public education is really important. Now, he didn't need parents to do all the education, but he needed them to tend to their children's education. And you needed a kind of education for the polis, right? Like you needed a kind of education. Like you couldn't just have the parents doing whatever the hell they wanted with their kids because the polis was more important.
Yeah,
and you need a kind of sense of virtue and a certain sort of skill set and intellectual capacities to be a member of the polis. So I just think about like how different that is when we think about education and the sense of commonness in some sense. And I guess it's not popular on the left or the right, right? Because on the right you have, all right, let every Tom, Dick, and Harry, you know, whatever, do whatever the hell you want with your kids. But then on the left, you also don't have a sense of commonness, right? Like you have every sort of pronoun and every ism and every subculture has got to be accommodated. And so I think someone like Aristotle would look and say, how could you educate for the polis this way? Like you have to have some sort of common sensibility that's developed. But of course, Aristotle also wouldn't have wanted women voting, and he was in free slavery.
Oh, right.
He also wanted the middle class heavily involved and heavily armed. He liked a heavily armed populace, which that might be one of the things we are doing well.
Well, but there was the citizens. Yeah, I mean, you had, you know, when the polis went to war, you needed. So, yeah, I do. I think the common. I agree. I think it's you know, I've talked about this before, but this idea of. You know, we pick and choose which libertarianism we want.
Which one do you want?
I don't want either. I don't want any of them.
Which one do we want? I
don't want any of them. That's my thing. I mean, but again, this idea of the common good. I'm in one level, you know, I am living in a state that's one of the more liberal states in the country, but it is, it's very libertarian. I mean, it was founded with strong libertarian principles, right? And even Ethan Allen didn't even like the Bible. He wrote his own Bible, you know, his own version of the Bible, a less literate version of what Jefferson did. So I think my pessimism about the Republic is right precisely around this area. It's not because, you know, that the radicals in either side of the political spectrum, you know, do they say things and do things that make me nervous? Yes, but it's this general loss of any sense of the common good. And maybe, you know, maybe America has always, maybe it's taken crisis, or maybe it's not our natural, maybe it's an idea we have, but maybe it's never been something that we've fully bought into, right? I mean, you certainly think it's what they tried to do in the Massachusetts Bay Colony, but their understanding of the common good, you know, that broke down, right? And it was still, there was many people trying to get land as they were trying to be part of the elect, right? And so I don't know. To me, it's an idea that I'm not sure has ever fully rooted in the American psyche.
Well, back to Aristotle, which is, you know, not, I'm sure there's not a lot of people talking about Aristotle after the Republican debate, but we're doing it, never stopped us before. And in Plato, even though they have radically different visions, I think they have this in common, that they imagine what's governable is a city state, right? And so these are not massive polities, right? I mean, there's a certain, like, and neither of them were huge fans of diversity, right? No, they didn't think in racial lines, but they just thought you couldn't have that much. You kind of had to have some common kinship among the people, and it could only be so large, right? That you couldn't govern things well on massive scale. And I mean, it's interesting. You think about countries that are our size, are any of them functional liberal democracies, right? Like anything like Russia, China, India. I mean, we're sort of the only country that I can think of on our scale that's still somewhat of a functional liberal democratic state.
Right.
And what are we at, 350 million people now or something?
Something like that.
The question is, are we just too big to be governable? I mean, and not just our populace, but our diversity. I mean, we're just so, you're in Vermont. What the hell does Vermont have to do with California or Oregon or Oklahoma? Right. You know, I mean,
or Mississippi.
Right. I mean, these are, so, you know, you wonder, and this is where, I mean, perhaps, you know, I mean, states' rights is kind of a bad word because of its code history, you know, of racist history. But I wonder, is something like that more, you know, like you look at California. I mean, California is doing all sort of progressive experiments that you couldn't do most other places in the union.
Well, I guess to your point, isn't the whole states' right thing, isn't that was the only thing that actually got all these very, you know, it's what prevented us from being the Balkans, right? That's the compromise that brought the Constitution about, and so you know we need to have a more limited I need to have a more limited value of what maybe the common good is, as opposed to if this thing all splinters, you know, or you end up electing a despot like a lot of other places have, or you have, you know, a despot take over like some have tried to do,
or Christian nationalism, right? I mean, this is why I think this Christian nationalist appeal has some traction and some legs, because there's the sense in which things are fragmented. We don't have a strong sense of national identity, and that sort of, I mean, nature abhors a vacuum, right? And so this is, I think, for some people, this sort of, and I mean, of course, there's this Christian nationalism in its racist and objectionable, reprehensible forms. But there's also a kind of soft Christian nationalism, right? That's not like explicitly racist, but is into homogeneity, is into a certain kind of, what did Tucker Carlson say? Yeah, I'm not anti-Semitic, and I'm not anti-black. That totally misunderstands me, but I am anti-Catholic for sure.
All right. Well, you know, I think the thing about it, but you look at, you know, we tend the accomplishments of Christendom, the accomplishments of the more enlightened caliphs, and that, you know, that how, for instance, how Baghdad flourished, under some really enlightened caliphs. I mean, and, you know, religion unified them. It was unified by, you know, it was not unified by democratic ideals. I mean, the Roman Empire was unified by power, right? And power and trade, right? And so
infrastructure too, roads.
Infrastructure, right?
Those roads too. Like I was reading an article a couple years ago, and they were saying, like, from a satellite view, like you can still see the Roman roads. It's unbelievable.
My favorite thing is, like, after the collapse of the Western Roman Empire, like 200 years after, just a short period of time, they didn't have the technology to know how to do the stuff that they saw. Like they didn't know how to work the aqueducts. They didn't know how to do the Roman roads the way they did. They certainly didn't know how to do that, the kind of plaster or whatever you call that, they're building. So it's fascinating that in a short period of time, all that was forgotten. So I think, you know, there's a sense where, you know, our politics, our politicians are all reflections of us. I really believe that. Occasionally we get somebody, you know, we get a better angel, right? Who someone rises to the occasion and we overreach and are better than we are. And occasionally I think we get somebody who's a little more demonic than we are. But the truth of the matter is this is the state of our country in its third century, the third century of the Republic. And I think you're absolutely right, where there are a lot of very natural political forces. That may not be a bad phrase, natural political forces, but you know what I mean. They're at work that are mitigating against this experiment to continue. And either the historical part of the historian in me says, yeah, that's just the way it goes. But, the citizen and the father and grandfather that I am say, well, we got to keep trying.
Yeah. I mean, and also, what does keep going mean? You know, you think about the British Empire before, say, World War II, right? Before World War II, England was one of the most powerful nations in the world.
You might say World War I, actually. I think World War I, I mean, they had the territory, but they were, well, but right, absolutely. There was
even pre-World War II, I mean,
World War II. You know, yeah, I mean, no, you're right, because they won World War I, but the
right, and they were still one. And after World War II, what has England been on the global stage? You know, I mean, it's without the United States. I mean, what you know? I mean, it might be the you know, it might be the most remote province in the Russian Empire or something. You know, like you know, gosh, where would you rather eat, Russia or England? I mean, you just think of
England. Yeah, without a doubt,
England. All right,
without a doubt.
Yeah, I guess yeah. Borscht is, you know. Yeah, but you know, you think about like, but just in a very short amount of time, how a country that is that globally dominant becomes not globally dominant anymore. And I wonder if that is there a future like that for America, where America is less imperial. Our size, though, that's the other thing. I mean, England.
Well, England was all based. It was colonial. I mean, it was colonial. It was built on the England.
Right,
yeah,
right.
No, it's an interesting thing. I mean, the other thing too is, it was interesting. China may have this. You know, China. Some argue China now is maybe more powerful than we are and strong. But it's fragile. China. There's as much. If I had to bet, which collapses first, the American Empire or the Chinese thing? Right now, I might bet on China collapsing before we do.
Yeah, but autocracy, though, has a way of being able to hold things together.
No, I agree. And, you know, there's no dissent, things like that. I just think, but, you know, their economic system feels a little bit like the Soviet Union did in the 1970s. I mean, Ronald Reagan did not cause the end of the Soviet Empire. Who was that? The Harvard, he was a professor. He was a senator from, I can see him, Patrick Moynihan. Yeah. Predicted it, you know, 5 years or 6 years before
Reagan
happened.
Reagan contributed in the arms race, right? I mean, because they couldn't. Oh, because we outspent them eventually. And, I mean,
he was the hard line was, you know, now I'm not saying there wasn't a contribution, but it was going to happen one way or the other.
By the way, that was the coolest thing of the debate, because it was at the Reagan Library. And I love that airplane that's in there. It's like the 707 or whatever.
Yeah.
It's actually in the library. There's an airplane hanging in the library. I think that's very cool.
That is very cool. All right. Well,
here we go. So everybody, that's our analysis. And so I don't think we're going to be appearing on Fox Business anytime soon.
But by the way, thank you all for listening. I mean, we haven't really done much promotion.
It's been heartwarming. People coming really out of the woodwork.
Yeah. So the 300th episode is not too far away. So
this is 298.
All right. So if any of any ideas what 300 should be, let us know.
Just
right?
Fly us to your location. Set us up at your church or something, and we'll come to you, and we'll do it on location.
All right. Well, we have to. I will say, depending on the location.
I'm open. I mean, come on. In the continental United States.
All right. No, it'd be good. It'd be good.
All right. Thanks, everybody.
Take care. Bye now.
How about that episode of New Persuasive Words? Thanks so much for joining Scott and Bill. We hope you enjoyed the conversation and will join us next time. Till then, thanks for listening, and God bless.